You're listening to a podcast by the Vinn News Service, an independent, advertising-free source for veterinary news. My name is Dr. Wendy Smith Wilson. Today, you'll hear journalist Jennifer Fiala interview Vinn News Director Edie Lau, co-author of a three-part series that published in July exploring veterinary education at the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, better known as UNAM, and the small but growing number of graduates who have come to work in the United States and Canada. The articles, titled Veterinary Recruiters Tout Openings for Mexico Graduates, Veterinarians from Mexico Recount Experiences in the North, and Leaving Mexico to Work as a Veterinarian the Harder Way, can be found online at news.vin.com.
Welcome, Edie. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Jennifer.
Nearly 12 years ago, UNAM's veterinary school became the first and only program in Latin America to earn U.S. accreditation, a distinction that permits its graduates to work in the United States and Canada, providing they obtain appropriate work visas and pass a national exam. However, I believe that oversimplifies the process, as you and series co-author, freelance journalist Steve Fisher discovered. Tell me, what spurred you to write about UNAM, its graduates, and their ties to the U.S. veterinary profession? Why now?
Good question, Jennifer. So, as you said, UNAM gained accreditation through the American Veterinary Medical Association over 10 years ago. It was actually 2011, so 11 years ago. And at the time, it was a controversial question. There was a lot of concern among some veterinarians in the United States that accrediting this school in a foreign country was going to open the doors to a number of their graduates coming and looking for work in the United States. And so this would have been just not long after the housing crash. And the economy was a completely different economy from the one we have today. Things were very slow. Probably every industry was struggling, and veterinary medicine was no different. Practices were worried that they were, experiencing not a lot of growth. And then there were these veterinary students graduating from schools in the United States with incredible loads of debt. I think it was well over $100,000 on average, even back then. And so there was a lot of concern about their future prospects and the thought that they did not need this competition from another school. So because of that, the UNAM's quest for accreditation became something of a lightning rod for those concerns. And we had a lot of stories, which actually you wrote, Jennifer, about mm-hmm. that controversy. So then spring 2011, they were indeed accredited. And then things quieted down. And then the economy got better in the next few years, and to a point that to today, I don't think anybody disagrees that there seems to be a shortage of people who are willing, who want to work, veterinarians who are in practice. There may be some veterinarians in practice, but they seem to not necessarily be wanting to practice anymore. So I'm thinking, whatever happened to UNAM? This is probably about 10 years after accreditation. I'm thinking, whatever happened with that? It just got really quiet, and we haven't heard that there's been a flood of their graduates working here. It seems like we'd know if that were the case, but maybe it's happened under the radar. You know, we should look back at that, because we did cover it at great length and detail at the time of the controversy. And one of the things I feel a responsibility to do as a journalist is, when we talk about things that, you know, might happen, which happens all the time, right? That's kind of the bread and butter of journalism. What might this mean? I think we can do a better job at looking back and finding out whether what we feared came true. So that was what started that. And then I, so 10 years after I was started to look for someone who could help us with that story, because I don't speak Spanish and none of the members of our full-time team speak Spanish. So we needed a partner, bilingual, preferably in Mexico, who could do that portion of the reporting. I actually, initially, I thought that person could just do the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was thinking, well, actually, no, there's this part in the United States where we have the folks who were vocal in their concern about what it meant to have the school in Mexico accredited. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, we need that part, and I can take care of that part because I had access to those folks who did a lot of their conversations on the message boards of VIN. So then, you know, finding somebody was an interesting, it wasn't like we were going to put out an ad for that. It just seemed too complicated to do it that way. And I actually knew a freelancer who spoke Spanish and thought about asking her to do it, but then she ended up not being available because she got a full-time staff job. And so I reached out to a former colleague and friend of mine, who is bilingual and well-connected in the Hispanic journalist community. And he put me in touch with Steve. And Steve's great. Steve has a lot of experience. He is he has done work for the LA Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post. So, you know, good, solid journalist based in Mexico City, is from the United States, bilingual, understood, you know, quickly grasped what the story was about. And so we divvied it up and away we went. This was late March. So it took us 4 months to report out this story.
So tell me a little bit about the process by which you were able to get in touch with so many UNAM grads, given the program's proximity and the language barrier, which I am guessing Steve did not have since he was bilingual. What was that journey like? You know, what role did Steve Fisher have in developing this series?
Yeah. So the first place we needed to reach out to was, of course, the university. And I actually, prior to Steve coming on, I was in conversation with a veterinarian who is a native of Mexico and practicing in the U.S. now. She did not graduate from UNAM. But I was telling her about this project that we were thinking about. And she was so kind. She said, oh, they have a Facebook page. Let me post for you on the Facebook page. I'll post in Spanish about your interest. And then she put my email address on there. And really quickly, I received an email from a communications person at the university offering to help. And he sent it to me in Spanish because that's his language. And I ran it through Google Translate. And then I wrote back by running it through Google Translate. But and it works, you know, but it's not great because I from what I can discern, it's very literal. So I'm thinking, you know, grammatically, this is probably not right, but it gets the message across. And I told him we were about to be working with a bilingual journalist who would then be in touch with him. And so once Steve came on, we did that. He reached out to that person. And actually, the administration ended up not really wanting to answer the questions. And frankly, we don't know why. They just kind of backed away. And I'm just surmising that it had something to do with how politically sensitive the question was and the controversy from back during accreditation days. But I don't know for sure. All we know is that they said, no thanks. And so we had to find other ways to get the information that we could obtain from the university. So part of it was, Mexico has, what I understand from Steve, very good, robust public records, law, and UNAM is a public university. So he filed comparable to what would be our Freedom of Information Act request, and was able to obtain lots of good data that way. And they also answered it in a timely way, which, as you and I and lots of journalists know, isn't always the case in the United States. So I was very impressed. I was very gratified that Mexico had this law and had a pretty streamlined procedure for giving a response. And then we also just needed to just, at that point, we just had to cast a really wide net. And so that's where I jumped in and dug more than I thought I was going to need to do. Just starting to try to using online resources to find veterinarians who were alumni of the program, of the UNAM program. And there were some in Mexico and there are some in the United States. And so Steve and I kind of divvied that up, and he reached out to those who were in Mexico and a few in the United States. And I hit up a bunch of the ones in the United States. And a lot of them, you know, when you just cold call people like that, you're not going to get anywhere near 100% response. Some I didn't get anything from. Some were responsive, but they were very busy, which was this real-life illustration for me of how of what's happening in veterinary medicine right now, with people just swamped.
They're so spread thin. Yep.
Yeah. They didn't have time to talk to somebody they didn't know about something. Not to know about, right? Or they were willing, then I couldn't nail down a time. Or they, you know, one guy we had a date to talk, and then he had to go in to work that day because they were down some people, and then one of his colleagues who was pregnant went into labor before they thought she was going to. So he had to quickly go in. So life intervened. But anyway, that was why we ended up talking to so many people, was because I just cast that net super wide. And I was hitting up people who were grads since accreditation, as well as from before, because I didn't know what I would get, right? I just wanted to talk about this program with folks and what they knew or of how things might have changed from the time before and the time after, and the perception of who had come to the United States to work.
Mm-hmm.
Whether there was a big community of them whom we just never knew about, or what. So we just, you know, reached out to anybody we could find. And some were in Canada, some were in the United States. I'm trying to think, I probably didn't reach out to those that might have been elsewhere, just because that might be too broad. But anyway, so and then Steve, I said to Steve, you know, help us understand the role of veterinary medicine in Mexico, the culture of the profession. And he was able, although, you know, the university administration wasn't interested in engaging, he did find somebody from the Career Center, and then some faculty members who were helpful. So that was great. And so then along the way, so initially it was just about whatever happened to these folks. And we were able to determine, indeed, there was not a big surge of UNAM grads coming to look for work in the United States after accreditation. Very, very few. And I could explain why in a minute. But here was the other thing. When I found one who had moved to Canada, she told me that there was a recruiter who was instrumental in her getting this job in Canada. And I was like, a recruiter? How do I, you know, can I talk to this recruiter? So she got me the number for the recruiter, and I started talking to the recruiter, and she's like, yes. Ever since, she had started working around 2019, but the pandemic was what really ripped open that surge in demand, right? All the pandemic puppies, so-called, that people adopted, and the difficulties of carrying on the practice, you know, following pandemic protocols and just things becoming inefficient. And so the demand that had already been building in North America, in the United States and Canada and other parts of the world really was just amplified by the pandemic. So she's, I mean, yeah, we're trying to, we know that UNAM is accredited and we want to try to help fill some of the demand, outside of the country with these graduates because they have this great, you know, this great asset of this degree from an accredited university. And that shifted the story. Like it, first it was just whatever happens, right? It was kind of a broad general question. And then it was, they didn't come right after 2011. But now there's a push to bring them because the demand situation is so acute.
Well, I think your tenacity in finding these UNAM grads really paid off because you got a lot of people to talk to you and everyone's story was a bit different. One gentleman, and I'm going to butcher his name, but is Dr. Leonardo?
Right. Baez?
Mm-hmm. Leonardo Baez. He first came to the U.S. in the late 1970s. So this is pre-workforce crisis, pre-accreditation. But his story is so unique and compelling. Can you tell us a little bit about his journey and his encounter with the Oklahoma Regulatory Board? I find that really interesting.
Yeah, happy to. He is a delight. Actually, all the folks I spoke with were delightful. They were, I would reach out and then they would agree to talk and then we would talk for, you know, an hour or longer, because they were so happy to be asked for their stories and, really grateful to that someone was interested and had such interesting, journeys. I wanted to say one quick thing about why there wasn't a big, a surge of people coming to the United States right after. And this issue remains today, which is a language barrier. So unless you have, you know, unless you're bilingual, you need, if you're going to come to the United States, or Canada, you have to speak English or for, in Quebec province in Canada, French. And you don't have that. And not only do you have to speak those languages, but you have to speak them at a pretty high level, right? Because you're a professional. You really need to be fluent and comfortable. So that has actually been a barrier, continues to be a barrier to this day, but there's some talk about trying to encourage students to really address that while they're still in school if they're interested. And also just, you know, leaving your home is a big deal. Not everybody wants to do that.
Right.
So it wasn't just like naturally like, oh, we're accredited. Let's go. They didn't necessarily want to go. You know, your family is still in Mexico. That's your home. So you may want to, but you may not. And, you know, a lot more complicated than simply, I think, to assume that, oh, well, if I can leave, I'm going to get the heck out of here. That's not the case. So Dr. Baez was a totally fascinating thing. He was an UNAM student in the '70s, graduated in 1978, while he was a student. So he grew up, his hometown is Cuernavaca, which is, in central Mexico. I think it's a couple hours outside of Mexico City. And it's supposed to be this beautiful, lush, you know, full of beautiful gardens. Tourists come there, and he was hanging out with his friends one summer day, and this girl caught his eye, blonde curls, and he said to his buddies, "I'm going to marry that girl."
And she's from the U.S., right?
She's from the U.S. She's an American. And then he went to a discotheque that evening and she was there. And so he went and met her, Margareta, and she liked him too. And, she was living there. I can't remember living there for several months. Her dad, they're from Oklahoma. Her dad was a retired police captain. And they were hanging out in Cuernavaca for a little while. And so Leonardo Baez became friends with them. He also, his sister became friends with Margareta, and they would hang out at each other's houses. And he's very charming. So you can, I could imagine how quickly, you know, the family took to him. And when they went back to Oklahoma, they said, "Oh, come visit us." And by then he and Margareta, I guess, were sweet on each other. And the next summer, he was still a student, and he went to go visit them.
And sounds like the making of a romantic movie.
I know. It's so it is. It's very much a story that could be encompassed in a movie. He goes there, and he's like, could we visit some veterinary practices? And so they visited one in town, and I think it was in Oklahoma City. And he liked large animals. And that was kind of what he was studying more so in Mexico. And so they also went to this little town, Alva, near the Panhandle, where Margareta's grandmother lived. And he visited a practice there. It was mixed animal, and he really liked the mixed animal, you know, mix of large and small. And in both places that he visited, again, charming young man, the owners were like, "Oh, well, when you graduate, come on back and we'll see what we can do for a job." Mm. Yeah. So that's what he did. So he graduated in 1978 and hightailed it back to Oklahoma, and went to the place in Alva because he wanted to be, you know, he liked the mixed animals, and got hired. Thing is, UNAM was not accredited then. So his degree wasn't recognized in a way that he could just get a job as a veterinarian in the United States. He couldn't just get licensed. So he's working for minimum wage, getting paid cash, and doing all the things he said a veterinarian would do. And he didn't bother. He was having the time of his life. But he also wanted to be a, you know, full-fledged vet in this country. So fast forward to there was just being developed some foreign graduate equivalency process for people who had graduated from non-accredited schools. But it seemed like it wasn't, I'm surmising it wasn't universally adopted at that point. You know, so again, we're talking late 70s, maybe early 80s. And so he said he goes to the veterinary medical board that is in charge of licensing in Oklahoma and says, "Hey, what do I need to get licensed?" And he said they didn't know what the hell to do with me. Because it wasn't, they weren't used to having, you know, folks come from outside the U.S. And finally just said, "Well, let's see, let's get your transcripts and get us your license in Mexico. And then, you know, you can sit for the board exam." And so he had no idea what the board exam, the national board was. And he just took it to find out what it was. And he went, holy moly, this is, you know, this is hard.
Like, yeah.
They're asking me stuff I didn't learn. And he was able to get on at Oklahoma State. Very, you know, very resourceful guy, like reaching out.
Yeah.
Went to Oklahoma State, which has a vet school, and was able to get into a program whereby he could study with the fourth year students and really bone up and, you know, do their clinical rotations with them. He boned up, took the test, passed.
Right? So did he have to pay for that education at Oklahoma?
He didn't. He said the faculty member who helped him was like an angel. And I think things back then could be a little less formal than they would be today. I don't imagine that could happen today.
Right. But he had luck on his side for sure.
Yeah. Different era. Mm-hmm. Different era. So yeah, really, really nice. You know, you had more person to person relationships, I think, back then, in terms of, you know, there was less, I don't know. It just seems like things could be done less formally. Mm-hmm. But anyway, you know, learned the material, passed the exam. Now he needs to get his state license, right? So that's another exam. And there's a written component and there's an oral component. And the written was fine, passed that. And then he had to do the oral. And it was a panel of, I believe it was five folks from the board. And, you know, he answered all the questions, but one of the members who was evaluating him felt that his accent was going to get in the way of communicating with clients. And because he needed, I guess, a unanimous agreement that he was good to go, he didn't pass. And so he goes back to the practice in Alvin, you know, works like as an assistant again, and decides, I'm going to take this again next year. And because they have to pay again, I think he said it was, I want to say $300, but I'm not going to swear to that because I don't have it in front of me, but it was several hundred dollars. Next year, he takes it again, same outcome.
That had to be hard.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's just like, that doesn't like me. I don't know what's going on. So he's telling his father-in-law about this. His father-in-law, who again is a retired police captain, well connected in the community. And he says, this sounds weird, and reaches out to their congressman, who at the time was a gentleman named Mickey Edwards, who was a congressman from Oklahoma for many years. And they had a meeting with him, explained what happened, and then got home from the meeting. And as soon as they got home, then Baez got a phone call from the vet board, the secretary of the vet board, saying, you are receiving your license. It's in the mail.
Wow. What a coincidence.
Yeah. He goes, just like that. Holy.
Oh. So, that's a great
story.
Story.
We don't know exactly to connect the dots. And I actually reached out to Congressman Edwards, who is no longer a congressman, but he's still around. I wasn't able to reach him, unfortunately. And even if I had, you know, chances are he would not have recalled this particular instance. I'm sure in his years in public service, he helped many, many people.
Right.
But I did talk to the secretary of the board, who would have made that call. And although he didn't remember particulars of this happening, he corroborated that it was definitely a plausible situation, and that he vouched for Dr. Baez's memory and said, if he said this is how it went, then I have no reason to doubt this is how it went.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that does not happen today.
I'm guessing, you know, if somebody has a story like that that's modern, they can let us know.
Right. I would hope not, at least. So that's a great story. And I know Mexico isn't the only country with a robust veterinary program like UNAM has. Yeah. So I wonder if you have plans to spotlight any other veterinary programs or graduates elsewhere in the world. Now that our workforce is so thin, we seem to be in need of a lot of veterinarians. I'm assuming many will be coming from outside the United States, so that's a possibility.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't really. Okay, so first of all, yes, I love learning about how things are done outside of the United States. I think we tend to be kind of U.S.-centric in our culture, and it's nice to know how things are done elsewhere. VIN is an international organization with members all over the world. And as the new service, we want to give them all a voice and to be all part of this large global community. I would love to have more stories of this nature about these other programs. In terms of those folks maybe coming to the United States, I mean, I don't know. I think, you know, there's other countries are having the same workforce issue, needing veterinarians and not having enough. And also the pet culture is spreading around the world. So other countries, you know, people are starting to have a growing regard for having animals in their lives and in their households, and bringing them is considering them part of the family. One of the interesting bits that we learned about Mexico is that they actually, Mexico City recognizes animals as sentient beings.
Oh, and wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that has both, I think, reflected and fueled a shift in how, you know, pets are kept and cared for in that country. So, I mean, and we don't even have that in the United States, right? We don't recognize them as sentient.
Right.
We obviously care about them, and many people think of them that way, but as a kind of official recognition, we don't have that. So, I mean, I think in Asia, pet culture is really growing, and I don't know too much about in other parts of the world, but I imagine that because there's this, we're such a small world now, right, with the internet and shared cultures or overlap anyway. I don't know. I mean, I just think many countries are going to want to have more veterinarians. So whether they, you know, ultimately come to the United States or not, I'd love to know more about the veterinary community in other parts of the world. We have a reporter who's based sometimes in Sydney and sometimes in London. And he's been great, Russ Kelly, he's been great covering lots of issues from that part of the world, and sometimes Asia as well. I would love to have a correspondent in Latin America, because I think a lot's going on in Latin America. There's the language barrier, right? So again, right, we need a bilingual person to do that. But yeah, I think there's just lots of stories to be told from all around the world. So that is something that I would love to be able to really nurture at VIN News in the coming months and years.
Well, Edie, thank you so much. And I look forward to reading more from you on this topic in the future.
Thank you, Jennifer. Appreciate your interest.
You've been listening to a podcast by the VIN News Service, a division of the Veterinary Information Network, the world's leading online veterinary community. Music was composed by Benjamin Olson. This recording is copyright VIN 2022.